You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 21st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time, and counting, award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Linda Lipson, the CEO of the American Association for Justice. Basically a trial lawyer lobbying group. Trade organization. Also on the program today, HSBC bank executive. Oh, we're going to break the laws again. Yeah, I know we're saying something differently publicly, but yeah, we're going to break the laws again. We're too big, suckers. Also, the question that those on the right are not afraid to ask. Will Obama attack Israel? Yes.
Obama won't be afraid to answer as well later on the program.
And some rather disturbing stories coming out of an elementary school and a high school. We'll get to that story about the FBI's flawed testimony over the course of 20 years, which sent many to prison. And yes, folks, the clown car. It's that time of the decade again, I guess. Koch brothers, at least mixed reports, but, and I had said this, we'll talk about it later in the program. Scott Walker could be their boy. And meanwhile, Scott Walker comes out and says has a problem with legal immigration as well. I just got an IM, and we're going to get to this interview with Linda Lipson. I had pre-recorded this when I was in Las Vegas at the Tor conference. Matt just farted, IMs me, saying that the TPP is not being voted on as a treaty and does not need a two-third majority to pass. It will only need 50% plus one to pass. I think that's why Cenk thinks it over. That is not accurate. What will be voted on, perhaps in the coming days, is the TPA, which is basically the Fast Track Authority. The Fast Track Authority then changes the rules under which trade, so-called trade agreements, are passed. And so that's what you're talking about. So the question is whether or not the TPA gets voted upon, and that is 50% plus one, assuming that there is no attempt by the Democrats to filibuster it. So it remains to be seen. It remains to be seen. Wanted to say a couple of words about the elections going forward, because, you know, increasingly, this is going to dominate the news. And to a certain extent, you know, I was on Hayes last night talking about the what was happening up in New Hampshire. And it was fun. It was a fun segment. And I'm sort of two minds of this. I don't even know if I'm of two minds. I'm probably of one mind and then one just sort of naked hedonism. I don't know. Where does my hedonism live? Well, it's just fun to talk about these Republican candidates because it's easy and it's fun. And so, and again, it's going to dominate the news for the next, well, gosh, year. I mean, the Republican primary. And we're also going to hear more and more about the elections. On this program, at the very least, in the first half of the program, I'm going to endeavor to keep doing what we've been doing, which is to interview people about policy, interview people about broader ideas. We may even expand it because there's probably not as much that's going to be published about sort of policy questions in the next, I would imagine, 6 to 8 months, although maybe it's possible. I don't know. But, I mean, but invariably, we will be talking about the elections and even this far out. So the idea that Scott Walker comes out against legal immigration, I mean, not as a blanket policy, but we'll talk about it later in the program. And it's important because Scott Walker, I would say, and I've been saying this for quite some time, I think is probably as well situated as anybody. And really, we're talking about Jeb Bush to be the Republican nominee. And then we get to find out just how sort of not quick on his feet he is. I mean, you know, this whole thing about the Koch brothers, and I don't want to spend too much time on this. I'm going to save it for the second half. But when I was on Hayes last night, and I couldn't help but remind him and Michael Steele that 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, whenever it was that it was announced that the Koch brothers were going to be dropping $900 million into this election, I was like, this is going to end up, not all of it, but they're going to support Scott Walker. Do people forget that when Scott Walker ran for governor, there was literally no difference between Americans for Prosperity in Wisconsin, the Koch brothers organization, and the Scott Walker campaign? Like, and I'm talking about personnel. There's what these investigations. I think it's like one or two people have gone to prison or have been at least convicted of stuff, sort of double dipping there. I'm not sure. I'll dig into that. But I'm quite sure that there is a lot of guys who worked for both organizations, and I think possibly simultaneously. And do people forget the phone call that Scott Walker took? It was a prank phone call, and he thought he was getting a call from one of the Koch brothers. I mean, it just shows you two things: who he works for and how not so bright he is. So we will talk more about that. But I feel it's necessary for me to, I don't know. I don't want to say it's an apology. But it is what it is, folks. But we'll still continue, obviously, to report on things like on policy and, you know, movements and, you know, the importance of things like the fast food strikes last week and on and on. All right. So we're going to take and this next interview is another example of this. I mean, one of the things that I have said time and time again, and why I continue to go to that conference. I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, it's PAP is involved in it and the Ring of Fire has me come down there to do interviews as well. But one of the things that I think genuinely finds that I am interested in is the role of trial lawyers, because They are much maligned in our society, and they are crucial. And what they represent is even more crucial. And it was funny. At one point, I asked Linda Lipson, because I went down there with, like, I think I mentioned this. In the past month, I've gotten two different letters. One from my insurance company, and one from, I can't remember where else it was, to be honest with you, about how my information had been stolen from their servers. My Social Security number, and my son's, and my daughter's, and my wife's. And, I mean, I think, I don't want to restate what I say in this interview, but you understand what the dynamic is here, folks. We are paying for their lack of security. They don't pay for the security they need. They could set up a system where your Social Security number lives on a database that is offline. They could query that database when they needed to with a number that they give you that's just your account number. And yes, it would cost them more money. So what they do is they don't do that. They have substandard security. And then you pay for it when it gets breached. And you could be paying for it for years to come. And I think on the day that I did this interview, there was a New York Times piece about the exact same thing. In the same health insurance company, because this guy was dealing with his kids. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Linda Lipson from the AAJ. Continuing our coverage from the Master Arts Conference in the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm joined by Linda Lipson. She's the CEO of the American Association of Justice. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Give me a sense of what you do as the CEO of the American Association for Justice.
One part of what we do is I run a trade association of thousands and thousands of lawyers. And we help them represent their clients by giving them education programs and magazine materials so that they can bring justice to their clients. But another very big aspect of my job is to go to Congress and help educate Congress on why the courthouses of this nation should continue to be open for ordinary people who are just seeking a fair chance.
Now, you know, and I think that that notion of keeping the courthouse doors open to people, I think that this audience has heard that phrase. But what does it mean in sort of a practical level? And what are the forces aligned to prevent citizens, and why are those forces aligned to prevent citizens to having access to the courts to get some type of redress?
Many companies believe that they should not be held accountable for the harms that they sometimes cause, whether it has to do with a dangerously defective car or a defective drug, you name it. And so what they do is they go to Congress and they seek what we call tort reforms to make it sometimes impossible for ordinary people to get compensated when harms come to themselves or their families.
I mean, I've told people, you know, when you hear the words tort reform, you should react in the same way you do when you hear the words entitlement reform. It means something is being taken away.
Yeah.
Some right, some benefit is being taken away from essentially ordinary Americans. And and we should say, like, it's not a question of belief for these corporations, right? It's really just simply a function of mathematics for them.
Well, they, I always say that they can fix this problem by making products safer. And they can fix it themselves rather than spending, you know, hundreds and thousands, if not millions and millions of dollars on lobbyists and PR firms to try to convince America that they are the victims. They need to look at their drugs and say, you know what, we've got a problem with this drug and we're going to make sure that it's fixed rather than waiting for thousands of people to get injured. What happens is there's a rationalization that occurs in corporate boardrooms throughout the country. Same old story happens over and over again, where a small fix of, let's say, a gas tank or an ignition switch, a small fix, not a lot of money, would cause a product to be safer so that no one has to go to a courthouse. That's the kind of reform that we need.
But I mean, do they make the calculation, like you say a small fix won't cost that much money. Isn't it the calculation in their minds like it costs us $10 per unit to fix, whereas $7 per unit, we already have our in-house counsel. Anybody who comes up against us, we can quash them because we have an in-house counsel. We could do this for 10, 50, we could push this off in 30 years into the future. And me as a CEO, it's not going to affect the stock price, my stock options, the board of directors behind me, they get paid the same way. Their compensation is all part of that. We're going to do a big buyback. It'll create shares in our values. So if we can, at the very least, punt this 30 years in the future, and it's a $7 expense then, or even if it's an $11 expense as opposed to a $10 expense now, $11 30 years out, yeah, as opposed to $10 now, this is just a business decision.
These are immoral conversations that occur in boardrooms. They occur in emails and documents, and it should stop. What we need to be doing is, instead of letting the buyer beware, we should protect the public against dangerous products, and no one has to go to court.
I'm glad you raised that, because, you know, one of the things that over the years on this program, I've had the opportunity many times to have little debates with libertarians. Mm-hmm. And many of them believe we should have no government regulation, mm-hmm, that we can simply have the tort system to reconcile these issues. If you if you commit fraud or you harm me in some fashion, I'll just go to court and I'll sue you and I'll win, and people will know not to buy your product anymore, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need any regulations. Address that idea. Like, why won't that work?
Because we need checks and balances in this country. And what has occurred over and over again is, I mean, the reason why we have safer cars, the reason why we have safer air, safer water, is because trial lawyers who pursue litigation on behalf of their clients to give justice back to their clients, they're telling the agency, hey, you've got a dangerous product here. Maybe you should take a look at it. You know, if you look at, and this is a wonderful thing. If you look at cars now, they're safer now than they were in the 50s. Despite the fact we have fewer accidents now than we did in the 50s, because we have airbags, anti-lock brakes, seat belts, roofs that don't crush upon impact. And these all occurred because trial lawyers were vigilant. They informed the agencies, and then the agencies took the ball and ran with it. But it's really a system of checks and balances that we have to keep alive, or else the safety of individuals will be undermined.
Yeah, give me more of a sense of that relationship between trial lawyers and regulation, because, I mean, to what extent? So the way you just described it there, it is you have attorneys going out there finding problems that are systemic problems, that agencies then look upon and say, hey, this is a systemic problem. Right. We need to protect Americans. We're going to edify this in rules based upon the statutory authority we have to. Does it also start, like, to what extent could trial lawyers also exist without some type of framework of government regulation? Or do they use that framework of government regulation as, like, sort of a stepping stone, too? Is there
they could exist, but it wouldn't be as beneficial as a system that that is complementary, where you have government regulation on the one hand and litigation on the other hand. I mean, a really good example, I'll give you two examples, has to do with the GM ignition switch. Defect was not known because the agency...
Some people may not even know of the defect, so tell
us about it. It's a defect within the ignition switch itself that causes the over-acceleration and the accidents that occur. And many, many people have lost their lives because of this little problem within the ignition switch. And it took a engineer and a lawyer in Georgia to say, look, something doesn't look right with this particular injury. I'm going to look into it. And they then alerted the agencies. The agencies then became very involved in it and started to regulate. And now individuals throughout the country know about the dangers and can protect themselves of the dangers. Something that just happened with the Consumer Finance Bureau. In the Dodd-Frank legislation, there was language that said you should do.
Let's hold on for one second on the CFPB because I do want to get to that. But in terms of is that GM situation, is that an issue of failed regulation, or is it simply an example of the limitations of our regulatory state in that they don't have the resources to uphold regulations in many respects, and they need to rely on sort of these like...
There's a problem with the regulatory structure in that there's a revolving door involving regulators that go on and become part of the industry themselves. So there's that problem. There's also no independent testing that occurs, and that the information that regulators get often comes from the industry that they're regulating. So these two together... cries out for you need another body to be involved, and comes with litigation on at the state level, and then the regulatory system can act in a better way. I mean, you could have a system if you had all the resources in the world where you would just have a super regulatory body, and then you wouldn't necessarily have the need for trial lawyers.
Right.
But that's never going to happen.
Right.
So this is a system that does work, sometimes better than other times. But in no agency is there independent testing going on.
And to a certain extent, we see also this dynamic incredibly so in the securities arena, where the Attorney General's office, I mean, to the extent that anything's been brought by the DOJ or even state attorney generals, to the extent that anything's been brought, it's been based upon stuff that's been developed through discovery in private and civil proceedings.
That's right.
All right. We need to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Linda Lipson, the CEO of the American Association of Justice, because I want to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Okay.
They've just come out with a very important report. And I also want to ask you about just sort of like identity theft. I have one question on identity theft that... because I got a letter the other day, and you may not have the answer for me, but I figure why not ask you since we're here. I am with Linda Lipson. She's the CEO of the American Association of Justice. Linda, we've been talking about the role of plaintiff attorneys, trial lawyers. I say trial lawyers because I frankly think that the American public needs to understand just how important trial lawyers are.
I appreciate
it's too
that.
Easy for the right to demonize these people because, frankly, it is in their best interest to make sure that Americans don't have these advocates. And regardless of why, and it's been interesting when I come to this conference to sort of see the relationship between the financial interests of these people, trial lawyers, if they do well, they're going to make a lot of money. But also, there is a very deep commitment, like one that I can appreciate both in terms of social justice here and a deep problem with bullies. And a lot of corporations function as bullies.
Why I got into this in the first place, because I've always hated bullies. And, you know, consumers throughout this country, all they're trying to do is get a fair shake. And companies come up with incredible ways to prevent them from getting the compensation that they deserve if their products are faulty. Like, they have come up with this this program called forced arbitration,
right,
which is now in every contract, pretty much every contract that you enter into involving a large consumer purchase, whether it's a cell phone or mortgage on your house or whatever it is, in the fine print, tucked in the fine print, is language that says, in the future, if something happens to you, you're going to have to go to arbitration, and the arbiter is going to be decided by the company that caused the injury that you're alleging. Now, that is just un-American and unfair.
Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, exactly. It's basically saying, like, any agreement I enter into, we're going to go to someone who is
completely unfair.
Other than the fact that I'm going to choose who it is,
right,
they're going to be completely impartial.
Right.
And, yes, it's a joke. And I don't think most people who sign these contracts have no idea that this is embedded in the contract.
Right.
To the extent that anybody is aware of it, they don't understand the implications of
exactly.
it. And on top of that, I would say that the American public is not aware of the broader implications of this, which is basically saying we are letting atrophy set in on our entire judicial system in this country. We are basically fundamentally stripping the American public of their ability of redress.
Right.
And all these issues are going to be resolved on the terms by the personnel of the corporations. All right, so that's a good lead-in. I want to get to this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau report, because this is one of the best agencies, I think, in our government mm-hmm. today. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. But before we get to that, I want to ask you this sort of personal question. It's not that personal.
That identity theft.
I have received, in the past month, I have received a letter from Anthem, which is my insurance company, I guess, or they handle it for my union, saying that my name and Social Security, my 2-year-old son's name and Social Security, my 9-year-old daughter's name and Social Security number, my wife's name and Social Security number, and other, I guess, whatever other details they have on me, mm-hmm. have been probably accessed, along with apparently 40 million other Americans.
Exactly.
And they said, there's really nothing to worry about, but we want to offer you this low-end, version of LifeLock. And it's free for you, or it's for 2 years, which in and of itself, it's like, I've read that is not going to help me or my son, my 2-year-old son, with someone. Second of all, 40 million, I don't care how enterprising criminals you are, they may not get to the S's for 2 years, 2.5 years, and they're still going to have my Social Security number. It's all going to be the same
information. And what if your medical records are released in that way?
I mean, I'm actually less worried about my medical records, it just so happens, than I am identity theft. And it seems to me that they could, there's a million different ways. They don't need my Social Security number. And if they so desperately need it, they could store it in some database off-site and give me a number, 5, and then they take it into their database, and 5 is associated with Sam's Social Security number. Who's going to do
it? It's a huge problem, and several of the companies are asking Congress to provide them immunity when these breaches occur. And we actually, the House Judiciary Committee is right now considering such a bill.
Right now?
Right now is considering such a bill. And
because they must be aware. Because, like, if I'm thinking, hey, there's 40 million Americans out there, the damages involved in this, I mean, it's going to take me at least
right.
10 hours
right.
to just get to go out and spend, I don't know, $800 annually to make sure that I have some semblance of protection. I'm going to have to do my due diligence to pursue this, because they offloaded the expense of their keeping it safe, and they wanted their convenience to be able to access my Social Security number, and they basically put the cost and the risk on me.
Right. There needs to be a system that would encourage companies to do the most they can to provide the security that their customers need.
Can we sue them?
You can sue them now, but they're trying to prevent that.
Because they're getting a sense that people are going to be like, hey,
people
wait a second.
People are saying, you know, there have been several companies that have engaged
big
in...
retail companies?
Exactly. I believe Target's one of them.
Right.
And yes, and people are very upset about this. And so instead of fixing it, which is what should be the response is this knee-jerk response. Let's go to Congress and figure out how we can evade responsibility. And that's just wrong.
Right. And then... and it seems to me they get that legislation. All they're going to do is whatever amount of resources they put towards their security now.
Right.
Why would they continue to put those resources in there?
In other words, it's the consumer that's ultimately subsidizing the corporate entity, because the corporate entity should be the entity that protects the public. I mean,
yeah, it should be implicit.
It's
if you're going to
take
my Social Security number, you're implicitly saying to me, I mean, look, for my podcast, people sign up through PayPal. I don't take their credit cards, but I go to PayPal, which is, frankly, pain in the butt. And they take a hefty percentage out. But I do that because they have the most security. I could probably figure out how to take their credit cards, but I don't know how secure I could make it. And I'm offloading.
No, it's a very serious issue. The House is dealing with it right now.
What are the chances that legislation is going to pass?
Well, the Democrats voted against the bill in committee yesterday. And
the Republicans voted for.
But, you know, again... I'm slightly optimistic because this is an issue that affects all Americans. You don't have to be a Democrat to have your data breached.
Right.
And so...
this is one of those things that are...
It's possible.
It's completely indefensible,
right?
Unless you don't have to defend it. It just happens on the sly, very quietly. Somebody drops it into the back end of like a budget bill.
That's why people have to inform themselves, because there's all kinds of maneuvers that are going on that can frankly hurt consumers, and they've got to be vigilant, they got to pay attention, and they got to be informed. So, and that's your program goes a long way in doing that.
Let's talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They came out with a big report. Tell me what that report was.
Basically, the report is about is addressing the issue of forced arbitration, which is this rigged system that companies engage in when you sign up. Like, for instance, if you bring your mother to a nursing home and they give you this huge contract, it's many, many pages. Tucked in the fine print is a line that says if something happens to your mother or your father years down the road, you're going to go through forced arbitration. The arbiters are going to be selected by the company, by us, by the company. So... let's say your mother has Alzheimer's and she gets out of her memory floor and walks across the street, gets out. They're supposed to protect people in a memory floor, walks out and gets hit by a car. The family is in so much grief and so angry and never wants it to happen to another family ever. And so they try to file a lawsuit. And then they are confronted with the fact that 5 years before that, they signed an agreement by which she has no right to their mother has no right to a jury trial and has to go potentially thousands of miles away to an arbitration that is just rigged.
Right. So
and what CFPB did is say, by the way, only 9% of all consumers that are involved in these arbitration agreements ever get compensated. So it's just completely unfair. It's not cheaper. All of the arguments for arbitration, that the companies have raised have been debunked in this hundreds of pages report that came out from the CFPB. So it's a very good document, and I think it's going to cause the CFPB to actually engage in a rulemaking that will say this, that arbitration is fine, but it has to be voluntary. So that when a contract is entered into, that's not the time that you decide on what your remedies should be. It's when your mother walks out and gets hit by a car. And after that, then there should be a discussion of what the remedies should
be. So that you could actually negotiate, okay, yes, I'm willing to go into arbitration, but we both have to approve of the arbitration.
Exactly. It has to be mutual, and that's fair.
Because the response that some people would say is like, well, look, if you don't want, if you don't like the contract from that rest home that you're putting your mother in, Don't sign it. Don't go there.
Well, I actually can
what
tell you.
What do you
say
to those people?
Well, the problem with that is that these are really unconscionable contracts because there's no there. You potentially are going to the only nursing home in the area, and they have the only bed in the area for your mother, and so you don't have a lot of choices. So it's not a, you have no meeting of the minds, and you have no there's no balance.
All right, so let me just clarify something. When you say unconscionable, you're not using that as a layperson. That's a legal term in terms of the quality of the contract and how a court would view the legitimacy of that contract.
Explain how a court should view that arrangement.
I mean, explain
not
to people just that notion
is.
Of unconscionability in the context of contract.
Unconscionability means that you're not of equal bargaining power. You don't have a choice. It's shoved down your throat, basically. You have to accept it. If you are signing your mother up for a nursing home, and you say let's say you X out the language. Let's say you get through the whole contract, which is pages and pages long. You X out the language. What occurs is the next day you're going to get called from the nursing home legal department, and they're going to say, by the way, We're not. Your mother isn't coming to our nursing home
right.
Unless you sign this thing. So it's really, it's kind of like a contract. They call it in the law a contract of adhesion, where it's just unfair at the inception. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the courts have not viewed it that way. Recently, what they do is they're looking at, and I don't want to get too technical, but they're looking at the Arbitration Act, and they're saying that the Arbitration Act. Preempts
the Arbitration Act of.
Sorry.
Was it? I mean, is it a recent act?
No, it was passed years and years ago. That was only supposed to be used for businesses, but the
between businesses
okay, because
right.
they're of equal bargaining power,
right.
Not between your mom or your neighbor and a big corporate entity.
So
that was
is
never
this something that needs to be? So in other words, and let me just recap for people here. So there's the Arbitration Act that was originally intended to be a mechanism to relieve courts of dealing with conflicts from a business-to-business perspective.
Exactly.
Because these businesses are both savvy. They both enter into a situation where they have some form of roughly the equal bargaining power. They both have the capacity to have a team of lawyers to look at this stuff. They both have sort of there is a symmetry to the amount of knowledge that they have. Because
I think
that's
the right word, symmetry. And balance. Here, it's you don't have a choice. I mean, if you're going to get a cell phone, you're gonna be faced with these kinds of clauses. And in addition, some of them are now saying, in addition to saying you have to go to forced arbitration, they're saying you can't enter into a class action.
That's right. In California,
that's outrageous too. Because if you are just injured, let's say you discover that your cell phone company is charging you $5 more a month. You can't file a lawsuit because it's not economical to file a lawsuit. So you need to band together with other people that have the same injury so that you can change the behavior so no one in America ever has to get ripped off like that.
So can the CFPB, via rulemaking, simply say that arbitration clauses are not kosher, or do they need statutory authority? And to the extent that they have the rulemaking ability, do they already have the statutory authority embedded in the act that created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
They can certainly make a stab at preventing forced arbitration in some financial products.
And then what happens
is the
Chamber of Commerce sues in the First District Court in D.C.?
We'll see. The CFPB has made a really good first step at this, and my understanding is that rulemaking will follow, and we're guardedly optimistic that the CFPB is going to come out with a rule that's going to protect consumers of this nation.
If people want more information on these issues and broadly speaking what the American Association of Justice do, where should they go?
They should go to takejusticeback.com.
Linda Lipson, CEO of the American Association of Justice. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
And that was the interview with Linda Lipson. I love that stuff. I don't know what is wrong with me.
You could tell how excited you were.
I was
your voice. You were very
really riled up. Now, part of it was also I was doing well at the craps table. So there was a lot of energy flowing through. But I'll tell you something. After like a couple of days of hanging around with those lawyers, like it's not hard for me to have imagined, you know, what was that one with Gwyneth Paltrow, the sliding doors where she walks out of the subway and she, I can't remember what it was.
That I don't know.
I have no idea either. I think I just saw the ad for it. But that could have been my life.
I have been getting really pissed about forced arbitration. I mean, and I'm not, like, no joke. That's enraging.
Where have you been? Have you been dealing with forced arbitration?
No, I've been listening to it.
Oh, all right.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm just, you said I've been getting really pissed about forced arbitration. I wonder if like, you're running into it.
Yeah, just all
in other
over.
Places.
I grab a tea, I go get my nails done, and then boom, forced arbitration.
That's right.
My face.
When you sign, when you sit down to get your pedicure, they make you sign away your right to get recourse.
And it's really frustrating because they might not put the right shine on.
It
and
is.
And I think as a working American.
And, you know, there's also, you know, this whole concept of entering into contracts. I mean, a lot of this has been around for a long time, right? I mean, the idea of sort of economic coercion, contracts that you sign, employment contracts, and that sort of concept now is just being carried out and played out in a bunch of different arenas. Folks, we do not have an arbitration clause. When you become a member of the Majority Report, if you want to sue us, you can go ahead and sue us. We don't say that if you find the interviews that I do not dry enough, for instance, like we haven't sold the dryness properly, you can sue us. I mean, I don't know under what legal principle, but we don't have an arbitration clause. If you find that, you know, Michael's talking too much, or you can sue us. We don't have an arbitration clause. Or if Matt is screwing up the music or talking too obsessed about wrestling or something like that.
I'm going to need to check my arbitration clause with the voodoo priestess that I'm using to put curses on you.
There you go.
See, I'm sure that's getting used effectively and on the proper course to snare you with it. Well, really sometime within
whatever
this
you
next
did,
election
whatever
cycle.
You did with your voodoo priestess, my eczema came out today.
Oh, so, well, that's just the beginning.
It's just seasonal.
You know that
seasonal eczema.
Where he talks about
folks,
it's just the beginning.
When you become a member at majority.fm or jointhemajorityreport.com, a significant portion of that membership goes towards my eczema medicine. And a much smaller percentage portion of that payment goes towards Michael's attending a voodoo priestess to inflict that eczema on me. See how this all works? And you get the economy churning in that way. So become a member today at majority.fm. Also, a reminder, there are 9 more days or 10 more days in April. I don't remember how many days April has. I've never been able to sort of remember. I don't care. You can tell me 30. I won't remember tomorrow.
9 more days
in April. That means you have 9 days to get free shipping from justcoffee.coop. If you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you will also get an extra 10% off. Crazy. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. And here's a promise I'm going to make to you. At the very least, today, and I want you guys to, we're going to put up the final perk that we have on our campaign. We only have 10 days left on the Indiegogo campaign, which you can find at themajorityreport.com. And this is really for either, you know, for I don't know. I mean, it could be for everybody. But I'm going to, we're going to do one final perk. I'm not sure what the price point will probably be $50 because it's, this is actually sort of work intensive. I'm going to digital download of, I think, probably 5 episodes of Cedar versus Marin or Marin versus Cedar. This is the show that preceded Break Room Live. It was Marin sitting in his kitchen in L.A., me sitting in a studio upstate, And I think at one point, like his dishwasher, the guy who was fixing his dishwasher came in. I don't even remember what we were talking about, but it was early 2008. And so there may have been like Hillary and Obama talk. I'm not sure. But if you are interested in Marin and you like the old depressed Marin, and I think I at the time even had a mustache. I'm not sure. I don't know what was going on. But if you want the old depressed Marin where he thinks he's John Lennon, he's got the long hair, it was an early technology. It was back in 2008. I'm going to post that up there so longtime listeners may enjoy that. And if you don't want to be a member and you just want to just give us a donation, you can do it at the Indiegogo campaign. You can do it on our website. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program wherein, and I lost my sound sheet. You guys got to give me another sound sheet because I totally lost it. I don't know where I put it. Oh, you're still doing the sound sheet?
No.
Oh, you're printing me another one. We got some good sound. Also, a couple of stories I know you'll be interested in. We'll also talk about that FBI flawed testimony story. 55, you remember that poor door story in New York City where you have mixed income housing?
I don't want you guys living in my building.
That's right.
When the time comes.
That's right. So what happens in New York City, they have a housing unit that has like multiple $1 million apartments. And then they build 55 units that are for people who make, I think, around $50,000 a year, maybe even less. 88,000 applications for 55 units. And if you end up renting one of those 55 units, you got to go through the door they call the poor door, because you don't want to mix. You don't want to mix the people with the $1 million units, because they get to go to the built-in whatever it is, bowling alley and whatnot they have at this building. But we'll talk about that, or we just did. We got more stories. All right, folks. Say goodbye to you freeloaders. Say hello to you members. You're going to love what we got next. 646-257-3920 is the number. Hey, pick up the app. It's free at majorityapp.com. Then you can IM us at one touch through the app. Or, of course, you can IM us through all the legacy IM addresses you may have from the years that have passed. What else? Give us a review on iTunes. Come on. Just do it. We should read a review every day. That's what we should do off of iTunes. I don't care. Good one, bad one. We'll be right back.